I'm Jim Lehrer, and this is Colin Powell. And for the record, I would like for all of you to know that neither of us is or has ever been a member of a teachers' union. A quick reminder about this man. He was born in Harlem of Jamaican parents, grew up in the Bronx, graduated from City College of New York in 1958, was commissioned a second lieutenant in the United States Army, served in the Army for 35 years as an infantry officer, later was deputy national security advisor, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President George H.W. Bush, and afterward he was Secretary of State in the first term of President George W. Bush. General, Mr. Secretary, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
A while ago, Lee Hamilton said, there is no good solution to Iraq. Do you agree?
Let me expand my answer beyond that simple question. I thought the panelists did a good job of laying out different positions. But let me sort of put that in the context that I know well, and that's of an infantry officer and how you go about a problem like this. When you look at a problem like this, the first thing you have to do is understand the situation and not pretend it is a different kind of situation in order to make it easier to handle. What we're facing in Iraq now, and what causes Mr. Hamilton to say things like that, in my judgment, is a civil war. It's a civil war that really broke out in the beginning of last year with the bombing of the Golden Mosque. Until that point, we were fighting an insurgency that we really didn't acknowledge was an insurgency. So we kept saying, well, we can start to draw down, we can do this, we can do that. And then it became a full-scale, in my judgment, civil war. The administration doesn't agree with that judgment, but if you look at the National Intelligence Estimate, which reflects the unanimous view of all the 16 intelligence agencies of the government, they call it something more complex than a civil war, with all of the essential elements of a civil war, and it's a deteriorating situation. What is it a war about? It's a war that is about power and survival, and it is a war between the minority Sunnis and the majority Shiites, with the Kurds watching to see whether they want to be part of whatever results from the civil war or not be part of it. And we have to understand that because it is that kind of a civil war, it is not a civil war that can be put down or solved by the armed forces of the United States. Many people talk about General Petraeus, but the one thing that Dave Petraeus, who I've known since he was a first lieutenant, he said all along, this cannot be solved militarily. Well, then what is the military part of the surge about? All it really can do is put a heavier lid on this pot of boiling sectarian stew, but only the Iraqis can turn down or put out the fire. When the surge was announced late last year, earlier this year, my immediate concern with the concept of a surge is that it didn't seem like it was strategically synchronized. You had three parts to the surge, as I think you heard from the panelists earlier. One, increase the number of American troops by 25 or 30,000, as it turned out to be. Secondly, build up the capacity of Iraqi security forces, both military and police forces. And third, make this government effective. It is the Iraqi political system that has to come together and start to remove the causes of the civil war. In the military, we say you pick the decisive attack. What is the main attack? What will really solve this problem? And the main attack is this political component, what the Iraqis have to do. What we're doing with General Petraeus is a supporting attack. Building up the Iraqi security forces is also a supporting attack, because we don't know yet whether those security forces are going to turn into armed militias to keep the civil war going, or whether they will be loyal to a government that they believe in and they believe represents the dreams, ambitions, and aspirations of the whole people. A lot has been said about Al-Qaeda, but you notice it wasn't talked about that much by the panelists. The administration talks about it all the time. The president constantly says, it is a problem with Al-Qaeda, and we have to fight them there, or we'll fight them here. But the considered view of the intelligence community is that Al-Qaeda only constitutes perhaps 10% of all the belligerents in this conflict. It is a nasty 10%. It is the 10% that is focusing on killing American troops, and they are the most effective 10% with their enhanced IEDs and the way they go about it. But it is still 10%. General Keane, I have to take in the task, he said two different things. At one point he said they're not going to be able to make it because the Sunnis now are going after them, and the Shias really wouldn't tolerate them in the first place. But then a little later he said, we don't want to leave an opportunity for Al-Qaeda to take root there. Fact of the matter is, the Sunnis will go after them, but we shouldn't rejoice in this initially, because the Sunnis are not necessarily then going to be on our side. They are the ones who are the source of the insurgents that were killing us before what is a civil war turned out to be the case last year. And so Al-Qaeda is something that has to be dealt with. And I understand why the administration wants to focus on it, why a military want to focus on it. But even if you got rid of Al-Qaeda, you're still going to have the civil war and can only be solved by the Iraqi political leadership. Much was said about Mr. Maliki and his government. It's a government that hasn't extended its authority outside of the green zone to any large extent. It is a government that it is as much organized around sectarian interest within the parliament, within the cabinet, as it is a government that has come together for a single national purpose. Everybody says, we've got to go make sure that Mr. Maliki has the will. So the vice president's gone over and told him, you've got to have the will. Secretary of Defense has gone over. The Secretary of State has gone over. Everybody's gone over and delivered the same message. And Mr. Maliki always says yes. But that's not the right question. The question that should have been asked at the beginning of the surge, as we move out with all of our troops, not only does Mr. Maliki have the will to do the political part of it, does he have the means? Does he have the ability? And the answer so far is a flat no. He does not yet demonstrate that he has the ability or the means to exercise that ability. And so we have this lack of synchronization. Five brigades went over. As General Keane said, they have quieted things down in certain places, but will those places remain quiet when our troops go away if we haven't solved the underlying causes of the disquiet? And my judgment is that that's not going to happen unless the Iraqi security forces really become competent very, very quickly, and they have not demonstrated that yet to the level needed to secure the country. And in the absence of a national government with capability and with will and that knows what to do and can make it happen, that will marry that security force to it as a national army, then I think we're in difficulty. And I think that's what Mr. Hamilton was saying. Well, then where does this all lead to? Where does this all take us? The Civil War will ultimately be resolved by, my view, a test of arms. Shias will ultimately prevail because they are 60% of the population and their militias can be pretty violent. They will prevail also because they are determined not to be ruled again by a Sunni, the way they were ruled under the days of Saddam Hussein. The Sunnis are struggling for power and survival, and it's going to be resolved in a test of arms. It's going to be very ugly. It's not going to be pretty to watch, but I don't know any way to avoid it. It's happening now, and the only reason it isn't more explosive is because of the presence of American troops. I think that as you get to the end of the year with all of these mystical lunar deadlines, September, October, November, Petraeus, now we're sending General Jones, a great soldier, over. He's going to evaluate the Iraqi security forces because the Congress doesn't trust the administration to do it. This is strategic incoherence. So what I think will occur is all the reports will come flowing in, but toward the end of the year, if the American government, both the President and the Congress, have not seen significant improvement with respect to the political situation and what the government is able to do, and significant improvement in the Iraqi security forces, I think the government will have to start saying, okay, let's back off and see if we can contain this in the way that Lee Hamilton described. General Keane says he thinks we have until sometime next year. That may be the case, but I don't think we have any later than that. And one of the principal driving reasons is that the United States Armed Forces, meaning the United States Army and the United States Marine Corps, cannot sustain this. It's a volunteer force. These young officers and sergeants and enlisted men are going back for their second, third, that fourth time is when you find out that it's a very married army, and they can't keep doing that. So I don't think the surge can be repeated over and over. So all of these things will come together and force decisions at the end of the year unless there's significant improvement in the political environment on the ground. A lot was also said with respect to the neighborhood, the region, what will happen. I'm not sure how much of a spillover there will be and whether it will result in wars in other parts of the region, but nobody can guarantee that. I think we should be talking with Syria and Iran. I talked to Syria, I visited Damascus twice, met with President Assad. It's a difficult conversation, just as Lee Hamilton used to have with the Russians. I used to get criticized for going to Damascus, but nevertheless, I went because I thought it was important. On one occasion, I was in Jerusalem, and Prime Minister Sharon said to me, "Colin, let's talk." Go in a private room. He said, "I don't want you to go to Damascus. I don't think it serves the interest of peace, and we don't like it here in Israel when you go to Damascus." He said, "Arik, thank you very much, but I'm going anyway. I'm Secretary of State of the United States of America and not the Foreign Minister of Israel, and I'm going to Damascus." And so he laughed, and he said, "Well, since you're going, do me a favor. Rockets have started to come across the northern border from southern Lebanon. Tell Assad, tell President Assad that we have enough trouble down here. Situation is very volatile, and to use his good offices to see if he could stop it." Went to Damascus, had a long conversation with President Assad. It's always a difficult conversation with he and his ministers. But at the end of the conversation, I pulled him aside and I passed the message, and he just nodded, he didn't say anything, and the rockets stopped that night, and Mr. Sharon thanked me the next day. Diplomacy is not always out in the open, and it's difficult. As George Mitchell once said when he was negotiating the Northern Ireland Agreement, "I failed for 744 days, and then in the 745th day, I succeeded." That's what diplomacy is all about. We should be talking to Syria and Iran, and you can't have negotiations or discussions when you put preconditions down that are the results you want. They will not do it. You can't say to the Iranians, "Let's talk about your nuclear program and suspending enrichment, but I'll only talk to you if you suspend enrichment." They are not in a weakened position. They're in a very strong position right now, and they will not negotiate under those terms. You can't say to the Syrians, "We won't talk to you, or we don't want to talk to you because you will want compensation." Well, so far they haven't asked for any compensation, and if they do, as Nancy Reagan used to say, just say no. But you have to talk with the people you perhaps dislike the most in this dangerous world we're living in, particularly when, with respect to Iraq, we need this help from outside. And so our wonderful young men and women are doing everything the nation asks of them. We should be so very, very proud. Tom Brokaw and I talk about this a lot, you know. It was the greatest generation of World War II that Mr. Gates was part of. I'm telling you, these kids are part of a great generation, and we should be proud of what they do for us every single day. But we have to face the reality of the situation that is on the ground and not what we wish it to be. And I don't think we've done that well enough in the last several years. We had a real high when Baghdad fell. On that April morning, everybody thought it was terrific. And for several weeks after that, ratings were sky high. Everybody looked brilliant, looked terrific. And then the second phase of this war began. And from that point on, we did not respond by facing the reality that was on the ground, as opposed to facing just wishful thinking and buying into it. Now, at this point in our history and the history of Iraq, we have to face the real reality on the ground and not turn away. I'll stop at that point because I'll give a lecture.
I've got about 35 follow-up questions to what you just said. But you mentioned, for instance, the strategy was wrong. This was mishandled, that they didn't do the diplomacy right. One thing after another you just went through that was mishandled. How could so many important things be so mishandled?
I think it begins with not wanting to see things as they were. When the insurgency started, and we all started to say, look at this, what are we going to do? The decision was made at that time not to have additional troops sent in, and in fact, the troop flow was stopped. When we could have had more troops, we stopped flowing troops.
Were you in favor of more troops at
yes.
the beginning? A lot of more troops?
Yeah.
Were you in favor of the Powell Doctrine, which would have been to send enough troops in there to win the thing?
I'm always in favor of the
Powell Doctrine.
The Powell Doctrine doesn't exist in any military document. It's something that was ascribed to me by a reporter, of all things. But nevertheless, it essentially, I'll take it.
So it had to be.
It makes it even more powerful. It was in the Washington Post, not the military manual. But it essentially says, choose your political objective carefully. Use all the tools available to you, economic, diplomatic, political. And as a last resort, use military, because we're putting young American lives at risk and young lives on the other side as well. And when you decide you have to use military force, then do it in a way that is decisive, that you are sure of the outcome and you have anticipated what could happen that might require force. And we had this debate. General Franks and I discussed it, even though I was no longer on the defense side of it. I was the Secretary of State, but I called Tommy Franks as a fellow general, and we talked about it, and he was comfortable with the troop level, and we then argued it out in front of the President, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Franks, and the other military leaders were satisfied with the troop level. And on the 9th of April, it looked like they were exactly right, because the regime had collapsed, Baghdad was ours, and then the circumstances that hadn't been planned for began to occur.
As a practical matter, I know you hate these kinds of questions, but I'm going to ask it anyhow. It's a what-if question. If the Powell Doctrine had been followed, forget Powell Doctrine, let's say 500,000 troops had been sent in there, and the plan was, the advanced planning had been done with the knowledge that, hey, this thing might fall apart if we're not careful. Let's send 500,000 troops in there. Would we be talking about a different situation today?
Be a different situation, but I'm not a fortune teller, and I can't say that everything would have been solved. But when we became the liberator of Iraq and the Iraqi people on the 9th of April, we also became the occupier. We became the government. And we were responsible for imposing order on that society. And that society started to shatter because we had broken civil structure. The military was dissipated at that time and then disbanded improperly, in my judgment. And the whole civil service went away. So there was no civil society, there was no governing structure. And it was our responsibility at that point to become the governing structure. And we did not have that as a political as part of our political plan, political will to do that, and we did not plan well enough for that, and we did not have enough troops to impose order. And the troops that were there were not clear whether they were supposed to start shooting people, for example, who were burning down ministries. That was a time when you needed to be rough, when you needed to impose order, you needed to impose martial law, everybody into your homes until we sort this out. And that didn't happen. And then as ministries started to be burned down, the very ministries we were planning to use to reconstitute an Iraqi structure. And we did not respond in a proper way, in my judgment.
General, one of the things that you said many times, one of the lessons you learned from Vietnam, was that without public support for military action, it ain't going to work. Do you concede that we are now at that point? on Iraq?
Clearly we are. But remember where we were in the fall of 2002. The Congress had passed a resolution that gave the president the support he needed to continue the diplomatic process, and if necessary, Congress certainly implied a sense of the Congress that if military action was necessary, the congressional support would be there. And then in the initial phase after Baghdad fell, everybody thought this was terrific. The president was running at 65% popularity, and the American people were fully behind that. And they were fully behind it, I think, for the next year or so. But then when you didn't see the Iraqis start to kick in, when you didn't see these claims about the competence of the Iraqi security forces to be real, and when it didn't start to gel, the American people started to drop off with respect to their support. And then I think it really hit a tipping point with the Golden Mosque, and the American people were no longer shielded from anything, and they saw in brilliant colors the nature of this country and these people and what they were prepared to do with each other in order to retain power or gain power and to survive. And that's when it really started to drop off and when we didn't see any improvement. I think if this surge were to show some improvement in not only quieting things down a bit, but in actually demonstrating to the American people that the Iraqis are now stepping up to the task, then the support might stabilize. But right now, I think the support has tipped over to the point that, you know, you saw the kind of audience reaction you got earlier when people are talking about some of the panelists were saying, Senator Feinstein or others saying, well, you know, we have to think about leaving by the end of the year. So I don't know how you're going to be able to right that ship of support. And saying that it's Al-Qaeda and they're coming here, I don't think that will do it in and of itself, because the American people understand that Al-Qaeda is a danger, it's a threat, but that threat is still also in the western regions of Pakistan and perhaps parts of Afghanistan where the real problem may be. And the American people have not connected Al-Qaeda Iraq to 9/11 in the way the administration would like. And the American people, I think, now see this is a civil war.
But wouldn't it be a fair statement that if an American people just listened to your opening comment, laid out the situation and the possibilities and this and that, whatever, they would say, would you not understand why an American people would say, forget it. Get this thing over with. It's not worth any more American blood and resources.
I think that's what they're starting to say.
That's what they're saying.
I think we're seeing that reflected in our body politic. You know, Andrea Mitchell gave us a little report earlier that another very prominent senior Republican senator has said we've got to change. And I think it's reflected in last fall's election. It's reflected in the president's standing within the country. And it's reflected in the general feelings toward Iraq, where over 60% of the population, close to 70, say, it's time for us to figure a way out. Now, what we can't do is just blow a whistle one morning and all 180,000 troops leave. That isn't sensible. It has to be a gradual kind of reduction of forces with a strategy associated with it. And I think you heard the panelists talk about this earlier. We just don't get the trains and leave. We say, okay, we're going to step outside the major areas of conflict and see if we can stabilize the rest of the country and protect it from intervention from outside while the Iraqis try to resolve this. It'll be a test of arms, but maybe it'll reach a point where there's sufficient exhaustion on both sides, as we have seen in Northern Ireland and other places, where they say, okay, look, let's come together, we're all Iraqis, let's figure out a political solution to all of this. One danger that is seldom talked about but is very real is down in the southern part of the country, where you don't have the kind of violence that you see in the center triangle of death, so to speak, around Anbar and Diyala and those places. But the southern part of the country isn't under great government control either. It's being run by tribal sheikhs, by groups that have come together and made their deals among the tribes. And it's going to be a long time before that part of the country, even if the central part is resolved, how you bring that into a federated system where they start to think in national terms and not sectarian terms.
I think, would it be fair to say that the end result of what you just said is not an optimistic view?
Well,
it's hard
for me to be optimistic, but what is it that I see at the end of the game? I see a country that has probably stayed together. Its three constituent parts stay together, the Sunnis, the Kurds, and the Shias, that will have a Shia-dominated government that hopefully will be sensible enough to give the Sunnis a piece of the action, oil revenues, political presence, participating in the government in a real way. It'll be a Shia regime that will be more fundamentalist than we would like. It'll be a Shia regime that will probably be linked more closely to Iran than we would like to see, but it will not be Iranian dominated, because we still have an 8-year war between them that is recent history. And it's the difference between Shiite Arabs and Persian Shiites. So there's that difference.
Let me ask you.
And I don't know how much that will spread and contaminate other parts of the region. One thing we could do, which was touched on by the panelists as well, is to see if there's anything that can be done. And it's hard to be optimistic at the moment because of the weakness of the parties. But the Middle East peace process underlies all of this as contributing to the overall instability in the region. So I wish President Bush and Dr. Rice and their colleagues all the best as they try to get something started with respect to the Israelis and the Palestinians.
A personal question. The conventional wisdom, I would guess, at this hall and majority opinion in this country among all citizens, whether they be Republicans, Democrats, whatever, however their view of the war, is that you personally could have stopped this from happening. What's the truth? That's what people think.
I know people say that to me, but
what do you think? What do you say when people say that to you, Doc? I just did.
Well, I just asked you how I could have. Yep. I tried to avoid this war. I went to the president in August of 2002 after coming back from a trip and seeing all the planning that was underway. And we had a long meeting upstairs in the residence. Dr. Rice was there, but it was essentially a conversation between President Bush and myself. And for the better part of 2.5 hours, I took him through not only the military planning that was being done in the Pentagon, but I took him through the consequences of going into an Arab country and becoming the occupiers. It is said that I used the Pottery Barn rule. I never did it. Friedman did it. He's next. He's the one who did that. But what I did say to him, once you break it, you're going to own it, and we're going to be responsible for 26 million people standing there looking at us. And it's going to suck up a good 40 to 50% of your army for years, and it's going to take all the oxygen out of the political environment. And you need to understand this, and the expense is going to be enormous. And he took it all aboard. He said, what should we do? And I said, well, we should first and foremost take it to the United Nations, because they're the offended party. It's their resolutions that have been offended. And I briefed other members of the cabinet over the next day or two. And we then had a meeting a week or so later. And every member of the national security team agreed with the judgment that we take it to the UN. And we worked for 7 weeks after taking it to the UN in September and got a resolution unanimously approved by the Security Council with some get-out clauses for Saddam Hussein to avoid the conflict. But I said to the president, if we can solve this diplomatically, are you prepared to accept that, even if it means that we have a changed regime in Baghdad with Saddam Hussein still there but no longer a danger or a threat, and not a regime change? And it was not something that he was immediately attracted to, but he said yes, he would have to. And we tried. But at the time I made that point to him, I also had to say to him that you're the president, you'll have to make the ultimate judgment. And if the judgment is this isn't working and we don't think it's going to solve the problem, then if military action is undertaken, I'm with you. I'm going to support you. And frankly, when military action was undertaken, it looked like it was extremely successful. It was the lack of planning for these latter phases and the things that got out of control that really has brought us to this point. And so I could have stopped it by quitting. Oh, I assure you that would not have done it. To quit while it was underway was not my way of doing business and serving in administration. And so I stayed through 2003. Then in early 2004, conversations with the president told him I thought it would be wise for him to make some changes in his team at the end of 2004 after the election, and that that would be the time for me to leave.
Pick up on another point you made. You praised the young military, mostly young military up today, who's fighting this war and dying and wounding, and their families. And much has been said about they're the only ones who have paid any price for this war. Only people in America made any sacrifice or have even been asked to make any sacrifice. You agree with that?
There's some truth to it. I mean, this is a very serious conflict, and we're paying a lot of money. You're all paying a lot in taxes, but the ones who are paying with their blood are the volunteers, and we have not fully mobilized the nation. There's no draft, of course, but we have not fully mobilized the nation behind this effort. We're very proud of these youngsters, and they're not all just poor kids who had nothing else to do. These are wonderful young men and women who are looking for an opportunity, but more than anything else, they want to serve their country and they want to serve their buddies. And they want to do the right thing, and they believe they're doing the right thing over there. But it is not a large enough force to handle all of the responsibilities they have there or elsewhere in the world. And I don't sense that in the American public there is a willingness to sacrifice much more or to do things that might make the burden easier. I don't see the American public putting that pressure on their members of Congress or on the administration. And I think what the American people have concluded was this looked like it was going to be successful. It was initially successful, but it hasn't gone well since, and we've done the best we can do, and it's time now to figure out how to turn it over to the Iraqis, to stand back, try to contain it, try to help them, train their troops. As you heard from the panelists earlier, we can do a lot of that. It was in the Baker-Hamilton report, and I think that would probably be, after the surge is over, the best contribution we can make to helping the Iraqis, and that is to train their troops up to take over these responsibilities. But American soldiers cannot sit there forever, even if it was another 100,000 of them. They can't sit there forever sitting on this lid of boiling sectarian stew.
Related issue. There was a discussion here at the festival this morning about the specific subject, and it went like this. The conclusion, one of the conclusions was, one of the speakers, was that the volunteer army has made it too easy for the leaders of this country to engage in military action because they're not connected enough to the populace. They're not, you agree with that?
Well, we didn't have a volunteer army during the Vietnam War. I mean, I don't think the evidence is there. I think when we created the volunteer army, it was with the understanding on the part of the generals at that time, great officers, General Abrams and General DePue. And I was a lieutenant colonel when we got rid of the draft. All of us lieutenant colonels and junior officers were mad. We thought the American people were walking away from us by ending the draft. And it took us about 8 years to realize that we could create a force that was far superior to any other force America has ever put in the field. But it was understood that that force would be of a limited size and capability, maybe to handle two small wars in two different parts of the world. But if we ever got to the point where something more was needed, then you bring up the guard and the reserves, and if you needed even more than that, then the nation would have to face the possibility of going back to a draft. I don't think you could get any kind of draft law through the Congress right now because the nation does not feel that level of threat and challenge. As the Reverend Butts said in his powerful presentation, Iraq is over there and it's a problem. But we've got problems here in America, and I think Americans are starting to say now, how do we deal with the problems we have at home? Haven't we spent enough treasure and lives trying to stabilize this? Isn't it now the turn of the Iraqi leadership and tribal leaders and Prime Minister Maliki and all of the others to now take on this burden? We've given them one last chance, but the surge can't be continued. And if the surge doesn't have the effect that General Keane and a lot of others thought it would have, then we have to move on. You have to remember that last summer, the generals in charge, General Abizaid, came before the Congress, I'm sure that Senator Feinstein will remember this, and said he's talked to all the division commanders and we don't want any more troops coming over. We don't want anything like a surge. And he wanted to start handing over greater responsibility to the Iraqis at that time. The administration did not believe that that was the right solution. They did a number of studies. They consulted with think tanks, talked to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and decided that they had to try the surge as a way of seeing if we could stabilize things so that the political process could work and Iraqi forces could start to take over. But as also noted, even Mr. Gates is now saying, because he knows the pressure on the armed forces, Secretary Gates is now saying, we'll have to start drawing down in the not-too-distant future.
Follow up on the volunteer military issue. You have to take my word for this. But I have it on good authority that President Bush said a year ago to a group, small group of outsiders, that if there had been a draft, he would have been impeached by now because of what happened with Iraq. Do you agree with that?
One, I don't know that he said it.
Do you agree with the premise?
No, I don't know.
Has it been that serious?
I'm going to play a little word game with you. If we had a draft, we probably would have had a much larger army, and maybe it would not have turned out the way it has turned out.
But the way I'm reading the point here is that the public would have been so involved and so touched in this in the beginning,
public
might not have even happened.
I come back to the Congress passing a resolution. They don't like to talk about it now, but they did by a handy majority, reflecting the will of the people at that time, this problem had to be dealt with. And in the initial stages, nobody was talking impeachment. Everybody was talking, this is terrific. And one other point that often gets overlooked. If we had not dealt with this problem, the way in which President Bush decided to deal with it by using military force, and I supported him in that, and it just went by the boards, and the resolutions were ignored, and Saddam Hussein was free to do what he wanted. There were no stockpiles. He had the capability, and believe me, he had the intention. Is anybody here sure that we wouldn't be seeing those weapons and stockpiles now? This was a man who was determined to threaten his own people, to threaten the region. He'd had such weapons in the past, and he had used them in the past. A lot of them were destroyed in Desert Storm and in the aftermath of Desert Storm with the UN inspectors, but he had not changed who he was. And so I think President Bush felt strongly that this was a problem that had to be dealt with now, either through peaceful means, by the changing the nature of the regime, or by military means, regime change totally.
Change the subject. Go back to our mutual friend, Reverend Butts said about the country generally. Do you share his feeling about things that things are really broken in this country that go beyond Iraq?
The Reverend Butts and I are good friends, and I have been to some of his facilities and spoken to his students, and I share all the concerns he has, but I would also want to put those concerns in context, because just above Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem sits on a bluff the City College of New York, and with my alma mater. And in the City College of New York, there is a Colin Powell Policy Center, which I'm very proud of. And you should see these kids. The college is 90% minority. 50% of every student is an immigrant, not their families, the kids themselves. And they come there every day and are killing themselves, working hard, coming from poor families, coming from homeless. We had a kid who came from Russia and was living under the George Washington Bridge. And now he's a Rhodes Scholar through CCNY. So it is still that place of hope and opportunity. It is still the place that, notwithstanding all the problems that Reverend Butts spoke about, and he's absolutely right, and I believe in, it's still the place, America is still the place, using the imagery that the Reverend gave you about the Statue of Liberty, you go to any embassy or consular office of the United States, anywhere in the world today, you're going to see a line of people. And they're all standing there, and they're all saying the same thing. I want to go to America. So we are still in that same place. We haven't changed. A story I love to tell, Alma will get mad with me, but I got to do it. Every time I go to New York, I love walking up one of the great avenues. And I'll always stop at a corner and buy a hot dog from the hot dog stand peddler. You all know, you know those New York hot dogs with the red onions? I love them. And I always have to have one going up Madison Park or Fifth. I used to do it when I was Secretary of State. I'd come out of the Waldorf, start up, and I'd stop at a corner. It was a little trickier then because I had 5 bodyguards and 3 New York City police cars running alongside. And the hot dog peddler would take one look and go, I've got a green card, I've got a green card, I've got a green card. But I do it alone now, all by myself. And I'll walk up to the guy and I'll order my hot dog, say lots of mustard and a lot of the onions. And he'll prepare it and we'll be talking to each other and it'll be an accent from a faraway place. And he'll hand me the hot dog. I'll take it. I'll start to hand him the money. And almost every time, the same thing happens. Aren't you that guy on television? You're General Powell. Right, yeah, I'm General Powell. I just want the hot dog, man. And I'll hand him the money. And he'll say, no, I won't take your money. You've already paid me. I'm here. Same spirit that brought my parents here. So while Reverend Butts and the panelists who just left are absolutely right that America has problems, think of where America was 49 years ago when I was a young soldier and entered my career as a second lieutenant. We were facing 2 great empires, one in Europe and one in Asia, Soviet Union and China, and they said they were superior in every way, economic, militarily, and they're going to challenge us, and they're going to beat us. And we had the strategy of containment, and everybody thought we were on our last legs. Think of the early 70s, from 68 to 74, when we lost Dr. King on that Memphis balcony on April 4th, 1968. And we lost Bobby Kennedy about 2 months later. Think of the race troubles we had in the late 60s and early 70s. Think of what we were going through with the Vietnam War then. This is peanuts compared to what we were going through then. Think of the disgrace of a vice president leaving office, a president leaving office. Think of that evening for April 1968 when we had to put buses around the White House, bumper to bumper, to keep the people from Washington, D.C. from burning down the White House in our nation's capital. And we were really shaken as a people, more so than any other time in my life. And then suddenly we stabilized ourselves. And this man of simple Midwestern virtues and values, Jerry Ford, came along and kind of reminded us of who we were. And we still went through some difficult times, but by the early 80s, we had come through that. We had restored our confidence in ourselves. And as I ended my military career, I watched as this enemy I prepared for all these years went away. And we were able to start reducing our armed forces, reducing our nuclear weapons. So it is that America that is still here. It is that America that people are a little unhappy with right now. You know the polls. Everybody says they're mad at America. I think they're mad at some of the things we have done. They're mad at some of our policies. They're mad at some of our personalities. But I'm telling you, the world still looks to America to solve its problems. They still trust us. They still trust America, even though they may have differences. And when you talk about the problems within the country that Calvin captured so beautifully, I travel around the country a lot, and I see a lot of communities at ground level, just the way the Reverend Butts described them. And we all try to do what we can with the wonderful programs he runs, with what my wife and I have been doing with America's Promise, with a lot of youth programs, with educational programs. We try to do what we can. But I also go to lots of other places in this country. I've spoken to probably 100,000 people in the last month and a half. And I go to trade associations and companies and mass audiences. And I come back to Washington somewhat renewed. People are hard at work. American people still believe in the American people, still believe in America. And they have seen tough times before. We've come through racism. We've come through segregation. We've come through civil wars. We've come through lots of trials and tribulations. Don't sell ourselves short. As the Reverend said, just keep pushing. Keep pushing.
Well, that's it.
General Powell, Mr. Secretary, thank you very much.
Thank you, General.